All right. I invite you to Psalm 49 this morning as we contemplate Jesus' question, what can a man give in exchange for his soul? I don't know very many wealthy people. I don't know about you, but I knew one man who owned several stores, chain of stores, I should say, and sold it and made millions of dollars. I was years ago had the privilege to be in his home and talk with him. That's about the only rich person I've ever known. But we know people who have more money than we do, right? And as a rule of thumb, people are rich who have more than we do. Rule of thumb. But we wrestle with the problem of prosperity, and the riches of this world are seductive. Wasn't it Demas who loved this present age and abandoned the Apostle Paul? But the riches of this world are not only seductive, they are also deceptive. If you could just have, fill in the blank, right? If you could just have X amount in your bank account, if you could just have this house, if you could just have this vehicle, if you could just have this whatever, you're good, right? That's the way our world talks. That's the way the world system tries to teach us. I read recently where in the last basically 40 years, the average size of the American home has gone from something like 1,600 square feet to 2,400 square feet. And yet we now have this blossoming business of storage rental units. Billions of square feet in America alone, where people are raking in dollars every month because we have so much stuff. So in comparison to our brothers and sisters around the world, perhaps we are doing pretty well financially. Compared to ourselves and our thinking, we may not be quite where we want to be. And so the world tempts us to pull our focus away from God and onto stuff. And we are haunted by the power and the influence of the wealthy, and we say it's not fair that the George Soroses of this world have such an influence. We talked about that recently, some of us. Doesn't seem right. We look at the Bill Gateses of the world, or who was the guy that started Apple, but I can't think of his. Okay, whatever, the Apple guy and all these other guys who have made billions of dollars. And we look at them and we say, well, look what they're doing with that money. If I had that money, I wouldn't be doing what they do with it. Probably we would. We would succumb to the temptations that they did, that they are. It's nothing new, right? The temptations to be envious of the wealthy has been around a long time. As we're going to see, the psalmist talks about this. So the temptation, on the other hand, is for us to say, well, let's just get rid of all wealth. Just take a vow of poverty. That'll prove how spiritual I am. Like, well, no, it won't. I'm reminded of a sign in the hardware store when I was growing up. It didn't make any sense to me until I left home and got out in the world, so to speak, but Sue and Obi had a sign hanging behind the cash register that said, this is a non-profit business. It wasn't started that way, but that's the way it is. sometimes we think, wow, I wish we could make more at our business. But Jesus' question still haunts us. What can a man give in exchange for his soul? What will satisfy your soul? And the sons of Korah put set to music, set these words down for us, and they are appealing, curiously enough, not just to the Jews of their day. Did you notice to whom and why was this psalm written? And they answer that, first of all, by saying there's a universal audience. You see that? Hear this, all peoples. Not all people, but all peoples, plural. This is appealing to all nations, all people groups, all ethnic groups on this planet. In other words, no one is exempt from listening to this wise teaching. And this teaching is applicable to all people at all times. And the foolish use of wealth is not just a problem for white privileged Americans. It's a universal problem. Every one of us battles this. And if you don't think so, you need to get out more and talk to people. Secondly, it's a universal teaching. Give ear, all inhabitants of the world, both low and high, rich and poor together. My mouth shall speak wisdom, the skill of living. And the meditation of my heart shall give understanding. I will incline my ear to a proverb, and I will disclose my dark saying on the harp. In other words, I'm going to set this to music. And as Jews, you're going to sing this in the temple or in the tabernacle whenever somebody picks number 49 when it's favorites night. But you're going to sing this on a regular basis. And you need to remember what it teaches. It's teaching not just us, or not just them as Jews, but us as Gentiles. There's a universal audience and there's a universal teaching. He is trying to communicate that the foolish use of wealth is a universal problem. And if you go and you talk to missionaries around the world, and as you interact with people, you will find out every culture wrestles with the use of wealth. Whether your wealth is communicated to others by how many sheep and goats you have. Remember Job? Remember all the animals, all the livestock that he had? And he was considered, what, the greatest of the people in his region, right? The wealthiest man. But maybe you don't have that many livestock after all. What are you going to do with all those sheep and goats and oxen? But maybe it's characterized by how many pieces of property you own. How many buildings do you have on your farm site? How many square foot? Being in the business that I'm in and talking to the people that I talk to, sometimes there's a comparison among different people, the square footage. How many acres do you have, right? How many garage stalls do you have attached to your house? Oh, the temptation is for all of us. And then the psalmist goes on to tell us, not only does everybody need to listen to this, the dilemma, he says, is universal. Death is inevitable, whether we like it or not. People die. Verse 5, the rhetorical question, why should I fear in the days of evil when the iniquity at my heels surrounds me? The glory of the wicked is temporary, is what he says. I don't need to be afraid of rich people. Now, even though they may try to take you to court, isn't that what happens in the book of James, right? Try to intimidate you with legal action. The psalmist says, you don't need to be afraid of that. Because their glory and their influence is temporary. But secondly, he says the actions and the attitudes of the foolish is very evident. And he gives to us a series of things. First of all, he says in verses 6 through 9 that their wealth ultimately does not benefit them. Those who trust in their wealth and boast in the multitude of their riches, none of them can by any means redeem his brother, nor give to God a ransom for him, for the redemption of their souls is costly, and it will cease forever, that he should continue to live eternally and not see the pit. In other words, you can't not die. You're going to die. And no matter how big your bank account is, no matter how many acres you own, no matter how many pieces of property you possess, ultimately, it does not benefit you before God. You can't stop death from occurring. The doctor does not say, wait a second, let me check your bank account. Oh, okay, you're going to live. That's not what happens. Cancer comes to you no matter what. Death comes no matter what. Secondly, I think the psalmist reminds us that everyone dies no matter how much they possess. Look at verse 10. For he sees wise men die, likewise the fool and the senseless person perish and leave their wealth to others. In other words, what? Death is the great equalizer. That's why it's good to look at the obituaries every now and then and to realize there's some pretty wealthy people who died and there's some really poor people who just died. But they both died. And even though one has a really long obituary and another has a very short obituary because they can't afford it, because obituaries in the paper are sold by the inch. Okay, remember that, by the way, when it's your turn to write an obituary for the paper. It's by the inch. But death is the equalizer. Death shows no respect for anyone, whether you are the wise person or whether you're the fool. You're going to die. And thirdly, wealth does not last forever. Their inner thought, and notice, by the way, how the psalmist seems to know what people are thinking. Okay? The inner thought is that their houses will last forever. Now, in America, we don't build homes to last forever anymore, but apparently in Europe and other places around the world, you can go into buildings that have been there for hundreds of years. It's going to last forever. Well, it might last longer than an American house, but it's not going to last forever, right? Their dwelling place to all generations. They call their land their own. By their own names, or they call it, they name it for themselves. They name streets and subdivisions after themselves or their children. You go to a hospital and the hospital has a person's name on it because they donated money, right? This is the whatever wing of this hospital. You drive down in certain towns and you realize that some of the streets are named after people who have lived there. They build massive pyramids by which they hope to be remembered. How did that go? How many pyramid builders can you remember? Right? None. But they have the wrong presupposition that their wealth will last forever. Nevertheless, man, though in honor, verse 12, does not remain. He's like the beast that perish. This is the way of those who are foolish and of their posterity who approve their sayings. You're going to die and you're going to leave it all. And even though you put a name on it and you got a memorial plaque put on there that this is because you gave so much money, in a few years people are going to go, huh? Who is that? What is this? Why is this named after? Yeah. People don't remember. So, the psalmist goes on to tell us that it is wise to contrast the futures of the unrighteous and the righteous. And he does that, first of all, by describing future destruction of the unrighteous in verse 14. Like sheep, they are laid in the grave. That's not a compliment, by the way. Death shall feed on them. Some of the old caskets were called what? A sarcophagus, which means what? A flesh eater. That's literally what it means. Sar is the word for flesh, and phagos is the word to eat. To eat the flesh. Okay? We dissolve. Remember when Jesus is at the tomb of Lazarus? Jesus says, open it up. And what's their response? He is going to stink. It's been 4 days, and he's going to smell. Some of us don't take 4 days. Some of us are shorter than that. But we all decompose. But the irony of it, in America, what do? We put our decomposing, first of all, we embalm our bodies, right? And then we put them in these sealed boxes. And then we take the sealed box that we've paid thousands of dollars for, and we put them inside of another sealed box with a warranty. 50-year warranty. How would you know? Right? But we sell those things to people with the idea that they're going to be preserved for a long time. You're dead. And no matter what you do, no matter how much money you spend, your body will dissolve, whether you're rich, whether you're poor. All the mummies that people have found are all decayed, right? All the money that was spent to somehow preserve them into the afterlife, they're all dead. They're all decayed. They're all decomposed. That is the future destruction of the unrighteous. But then the psalmist says in verse 15, there is a future restoration. But God will redeem my soul from the power of the grave, for he shall receive me. Now, I'm not going to claim to understand all what the psalmist understands here, but it gives me a hint that there is something about a resurrection of some kind. I think it's very similar to Job, that in my flesh I will see God. There is some hope that is there for the righteous. But I want you to remember that only God can redeem our entire lives. Not just my soul, not just my heart, but God is going to redeem our bodies. Okay? Our whole bodies, our body, soul, and spirit will be reunited, and it will be glorified, and we will stand in the presence of God. Only God can do that. And that gives us hope as believers. What a promise that God will receive us and take us to himself. What hope that gives to us. And whether I'm rich or whether I'm poor, God will redeem my entire life. Not because of my wealth or not because of the absence of wealth, but because of the grace and the mercy of God. So keep that verse in mind. May I remind you to, or let me encourage you to put it down as a reminder. God will redeem my soul from the power of the grave. That's hope. Lastly, the psalmist tells us, if we can summarize what he says, you can't take it with you. And the old joke about hearses do not have trailer hitches on them, there's a reason for that, right? And I don't know if they're still doing this, but a few years ago it became trendy to put drawers in the coffins so you could pass things on for whomever. You can't take it with you. Numerous cultures have done that, right, throughout the years, buried people with their favorite weapons, with their favorite toys, with their favorite things, with food for the afterlife, with servants. Some cultures would kill the servants of the wealthy person so he or she would have somebody to take care of them in the next life. You can't take it with you. The psalmist tells us, do not be afraid when one becomes rich, when the glory of his house is increased. He's got a good reputation. Everybody knows him to be the wealthiest landowner in the area. Don't be afraid of that. Don't be intimidated by that. Why? For when he dies, not if, but when he dies, he shall carry nothing away. Okay? You don't need pockets in the suit that you're going to be buried in. Can't take anything with you. You don't need to take your purse or your backpack or a suitcase. Your glory will not descend after you. All of your reputation that you had maybe as you lived in this life, you cannot take your reputation with you. This is why some foolishly invest in cryogenics, where they freeze parts of their bodies with liquid nitrogen to 240 or 460 degrees below in the hope that someday they will be restored to life. That seems silly, does it not, in light of the scriptures? Verse 18, though while he lives, he blesses himself. He congratulates himself on how much he has. Because men will praise you when you do well for yourself. Well, good job. I'm impressed with how much you own. That's good for you. He will go to the generation of his fathers. They shall never see light. Joining your ancestors in eternal darkness. And lastly, verse 20, and a repeat of verse 12. A man who is in honor yet does not understand is like the beasts that perish. And you look at the wealthy man. And is it in Luke 16 thereabouts where Jesus goes to, where God speaks to the rich man and he says, you fool. Tonight, your soul will be required of you. Why? Because the wealthy man did not consider eternity. And what it means to live in light of eternity, that's why this man, though he is in honor, yet he does not understand. He had wisdom to accumulate wealth, but he did not have the wisdom to prepare for eternity. He has no understanding. So, can I wrap this up with three things? First of all, and we have to say this in our culture, the problem is not wealth. Wealth is not evil, contrary to some would-be politicians and social justice warriors. The problem is not wealth. It is not sinful to possess things. The problem is the misplaced focus and the misplaced faith. In other words, it will do no good to redistribute the wealth to others, as some have foolishly suggested. Removing their wealth and giving it to somebody else does not make them better, does not make this person better. It doesn't change the heart. The problem is the heart, not the size of the bank account. Secondly, the hope of the righteous is better than the false security of the wicked. The poor widow who struggles to get by has a greater hope than the wealthy person who continues to count their money and place their faith in their wealth. Right? Why? Because that person who, and the scriptures tell us that God has chosen the poor in this world to be rich in faith because they have to trust God. The hope of the righteous is better than the false security of the wicked. You can rest at night because of the hope that God has given to you. Whereas the scriptures tell us that the rich person has to worry about people stealing all his stuff. Did he lock that? Did I chain that up? Did I make sure that I get all that put in the safe? Do I get all this take? Oh, I hope the stock market doesn't change while I'm asleep. You don't have to worry about that. Because your hope is in God, not in your stuff. And thirdly, the destiny of the righteous is better than the fleeting glory of the wicked. You may not have the biggest house, you may not have the biggest farm. You might not have the newest car, you might not have the biggest bank account. But your destiny in the presence of God is better than any of the glory that this world has to offer. You can know God. And you will be going into the presence of God, who is far wealthier than any person you will ever meet on this planet. God owns everything. Stop and think about that. There will come a day when George Soros, or pick the man who, whoever you think is the wealthiest person in the world, doesn't matter. I don't care. But think about that they are going to someday stand in the presence of God. And they may say, look, I've owned all this. I've made billions of dollars. And God can just simply turn and show him the universe and say, this is what I own. Puts it in perspective. God owns everything. And he allows people to possess. There's nothing wrong with that. But if you think that the fleeting glory of what you possess now is going to benefit you for eternity, you're wrong. And lastly, Jesus did say it is hard for the rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. Didn't say that it would never happen, because there are some wealthy people who do go to heaven. But it's really hard. It's difficult. It is only by the grace of God that anybody can ever stand in the presence of God. And it's not your accumulated wealth or your lack of wealth that qualifies you to enter into the presence of God. It's the grace of God. It's the mercy of God. And so the psalmist, as they write this to be sung in the tabernacle and in the temple, and as they write for all of us as Gentiles, stop and think. Stop and think about this whole issue of wealth. Wealth is not the problem. The heart is. But we, by the mercy and the grace of God, who have been brought into a right relationship with God, have been given a hope, right? We have been redeemed, not with corruptible things like silver and gold, right? Peter tells us, but with the precious blood of Christ, as of a lamb without spot and without blemish. We have something far better. We have something eternal. We have something infinitely better. And as frustrating as it may be at times, and as difficult as the battle may be with the seduction of wealth in our culture, keep your focus where it needs to be, upon your eternal wealth, eternal joy, eternal benefits that God has given to us through the blood of Jesus Christ.